Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this April 1st, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Pleasure to have you here. Sorry for those of you who've been waiting. We delayed today's hearing until 1:30 for logistical reasons, but we're ready to do some work. We have a couple of work sessions, bills to be worked on, and then we have a public hearing on the issue of unemployment insurance for education workers. So I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 491. And Senator Montes Anderson, could you come up? And Matt, remind us what this bill is about, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 491 prohibits a state agency from pre-qualifying a prospective bidder that employs 40 or more workers unless the prospective bidder submits a certificate showing participation in the Department of Administrative Services pay equity training program. It also directs the department to establish a pay equity training program and requires contractors to allow employees to discuss compensation and benefits with other employees without retaliation. The measure becomes operative on January 1st, 2016 and declares an emergency effective on passage. There's also a -1 amendment for this measure that removes the emergency clause, outlines the pay equity training program details, and applies only to employers with 50 or more employees with a contract that exceeds $500,000.
Okay, thank you, Matt. And this bill came to us from Senator Montes Anderson, you may remember, and she has been very helpful in the creation of the -1 amendments. So, Senator Montes Anderson, could you explain to us what those amendments
do? Yes. Again, I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. I am asking for your support of the -1 amendments. I have been working actually with the governor's office on this. It basically will, the -1s will replace the current bill, printed bill, and it's essentially the same as Senate Bill 491, and it will continue to do what it was originally intended to do. But here are the key changes. One change is the removal of the labor compliance check at pre-qualification. In the introduced bill, contracting agencies were originally required to show their understanding of pay equity laws at two different stages, the pre-qualification stage as well as the responsible bidder application, which occurs when a contract is awarded. And due to the concerns of redundancy, this amendment removes the pre-qualification piece so that contracting agencies would only have to show their compliance once. I'd also like to clarify that this amendment only applies to state contracting agencies. Local government agencies are excluded from the bill. Certification of the training is only needed when the bid on state contracts is over $500,000 and if the bidder has more than 50 employees. The training program does not require a fee, and the Department of Administrative Services will offer that training for free. So I would urge you to pass Senate Bill 491 with the -1 amendments. I think it's an extremely important piece of legislation that's going to help level the playing field for women in our state and bring us one step closer to equal pay in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Thanks for your help with this. Vice Chair Thatcher, you had some questions about it. Have your questions been answered?
She actually did answer some of them because I was wondering about the cost.
Yes.
And I guess that maybe now, I guess, do we have a fiscal? Is there a cost to the agency? Because apparently if they're providing it for free, is it going to be on the Internet? Is it?
Yes, it'll be online.
Okay, so it's going to be, and then a one-time thing. It says for a person to bid, and I'm thinking that's probably going to apply to companies, right?
Yes.
90%
yes.
of the time, probably.
Well, 50, for companies with 50 or more employees.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So in order for them to bid, they would have to have gone through this to get pre-qualified. In other words, to get pre-qualified to bid, not just for submitting the bid.
Now, to be pre-qualified, they can submit their request, and I think I would have to have, I don't know if someone's here from DAS, but it's my understanding to be I'm not sure if there's a step before pre-qualification.
Someone's coming up to explain it, yeah.
Oh, good.
And so we can get that question answered. And, you know, again, I think that we talked about this last time during the public hearing, that the assumption is that there would be one person from the company that would be the appropriate person to do this, you know, presumably either the head of the company or the HR person or whoever would be the appropriate person would need to show that they have taken this free online tutorial.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer at DAS. I think I'm not a procurement person, but I think I can respond to your question. And that is that the training would be required after the responsible bidder application.
Yeah. It happens after the selection or bidding, but before a contract is awarded.
And I did have a question about how employees were counted. And that sounds like a really strange question. Is it a matter of head count from a snapshot in time? Is it an average over a period of time? Is it an equivalent of FTEs? How does one count employees?
Senator Denbrough, members of the committee, I'm not exactly sure how procurement determined what those numbers of employees would be, but we can certainly get that back to you.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I guess I have an outstanding question, but it sounds like we're going to be moving it.
I think so.
Okay. So I'll probably be giving a courtesy for now. Just
okay, and we'll try to get an answer
to
that.
Yeah.
Great.
I'd like to know.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
All right. Back to you. Thank you very much, Chair.
Yeah. Madeline, don't go too far. We may need you for the next bill. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
You ready on this one?
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 491, dated March 17th, 2015.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 491, dated March 17, 2015. Any further discussion of the amendment? Is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Where are we at? Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
As amended. I'm sorry. Yes. Let me start again. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the bill? Yes.
Yes.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, two things. I need to declare a potential conflict of interest in that I could possibly be one of these affected people or companies.
In your other life.
In my other life.
Yes.
And also that I am giving a courtesy yes for now. I might change my vote on the floor. I don't know. I kind of doubt it, but just let me know.
Yes. Appreciate the putting that on the record. Actually, I'm not sure that in the Senate we have to declare conflicts of interest in committee.
Well,
do we?
Abundance of. I think I'd rather do it than not.
Right.
So
great. I know you do on the floor. Okay. So is there any further discussion of the motion? Carrie, would you call? No, actually, there's no objection to us moving this forward. So seeing none. Senate Bill 491 has passed. Yes, and Senator Gelser is excused today. Thanks, Gary. So I'll close the work session. Senator Montes Anderson will carry. So I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 491. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 291. And Matt, could you remind us of what this is?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 291 modifies the circumstances under which an injured state worker has the right to reinstatement or reemployment, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a Dash 1 amendment to this bill that requires all permanent restrictions to be known, removes the medically stationary requirement, and requires replacement in another position rather than any position. This measure has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Mr. Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 291 dated March 16th, 2015.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 291 dated March 16th, 2015. Any discussion of the amendments?
They were just technical, seemed like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Any objection to our adopting these amendments? All right. Seeing none, they are adopted. Vice Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Senator Rosenbaum? Yes.
No, I thought you were going to ask for a carrier.
Yes.
I'll
Would you like to carry?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Rosenbaum will carry. And with that, I will close this work session. Okay, time to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 470. Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 470 repeals the law preventing certain employees of educational institutions from receiving unemployment insurance benefits during school breaks.
Okay. Let us hear from a few people. Actually, can we bring up a fourth chair, and then I'll bring up Tricia Smith, Anna Taylor, Beth Lambert, and Sydney Meyer. Ladies, welcome. Pleasure to have you. Tricia, did you want to start off?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents about 20,000 classified school employees who work in Oregon's Head Start associations, K-12 districts, ESDs, and community colleges. They are hourly rate employees who are paid by the hour for the hours that they work. They work in more than 100 different classifications throughout the state, but predominantly the ones that you're most familiar with are educational assistants, school bus drivers, food service workers, maintenance workers, custodians, secretaries, that sort of workforce. Senate Bill 470 was requested by OSEA to address what is a crisis for our members and their families that they face when they're laid off and without income each year because their employers have shut their doors between academic terms or years. I use the word crisis because for these educators, that's exactly what it is. You'll hear firsthand their stories, and you'll see on OLIS the many more stories from educators across the state who couldn't take the time to come and give you their testimony themselves in person. They can't take the time off work. Many legislators and the public are content in the knowledge that classified school employees are highly trained in their professions. School bus drivers, for example, are the most highly trained professional drivers on the road today. They must not only know and understand how to operate that very large vehicle in traffic, they must also know and understand how to drive while at the same time managing the students behind them on the bus. Custodians are not just custodians today. They must understand and be trained on issues such as infectious disease transmission, integrated pest management, student behavior management, and building systems maintenance and repair. Where once there was a full staff of IT professionals in a school, today there may be only one. That staff was able to specialize in the past. Today that one remaining employee is going to have to know how to do everything from networks to desktops, from district financial management programs to student iPad use and programming, and instructional assistants, many of whom have teaching degrees, teach our most vulnerable students, from the youngest in Head Start to the struggling high school student. They must know how to provide instruction and understand effective behavior management techniques. And in the case of special education assistants, they must also understand, often, how to provide many medical procedures to those students. Whether they drive a school bus, keep major building systems operational, assure classrooms are free of pathogens and clean, or install and repair technology, or provide direct teaching to students, classified employees help educate our students and allow schools to run safely and efficiently every day. These are professionals who have chosen the education of our state's children as their calling, and they hope to remain in their field throughout their careers. It's a workforce upon whom we all depend, and more importantly, upon whom our students and our school districts depend. However, many legislators and the public at large are unaware that classified school employees' ability to continue to work in the professions they love is challenged every day by the knowledge that they're shortchanging their own families in exchange for providing a safe, healthy educational experience for the students in their communities. Unlike school administrators and teachers, classified employees are hourly, often low-wage, employees who are not compensated based on an annual salary, but only earn income for the hours that they work. Classified school employees are the only remaining large group of hourly wage workers, including seasonal workers, who are not eligible to receive unemployment compensation when their employer closes their workplace and lays them off. Classified school employees must pay into the unemployment system each month, even though they're not allowed to access that system other than in exceptional circumstances. Every year, many of these dedicated professionals decide they must leave to find other jobs because they simply cannot afford to live months at a time without income. Although providing unemployment insurance is considered a mandatory cost of doing business for every other employer, school districts and other education entities, with agreement from the legislature, are allowed to avoid this responsibility. Each year, school districts must face the hidden costs of very high turnover in its highly trained and qualified workforce that's necessary to provide the education that students require. These employees deserve the same respect and consideration as other educators, and in the case of eligibility for unemployment insurance, when they're laid off, the same respect and consideration as virtually every other worker. We hope Senate Bill 470 and this hearing open your eyes to this injustice, and that we can begin a serious discussion of how school districts can provide the same basic insurance program to our educators that every other employer must provide to every other worker. We hope that you'll help and support us in this effort for the sake of our dedicated educators and for our students who rely on them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go down. Who wants to go next?
I will. Yes. Well, hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Beth Lampert. I'm from Prineville. I work for Crook County School District. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about my story. My son, he died in my arms when he was 8 years old. He was multiply handicapped. And after the grieving process and time, I realized how much I missed that community and I needed work. And I thought, the school, I want to go to work in special ed. And I was excited. My first job was working with a student with Downs. And since then, I've worked in many different capacities as an EA and with many different student types. And basically what I do now is work in the regular classroom with our special ed children. And here you have a classroom with 30 students and two or three SPED students. And who's going to educate them? They listen to the teacher, but they don't get it. So my job is to take what the teacher is offering and put it in a way that they can understand and be successful. And it's really neat the way I'm able to work. The teachers are quite trusting. We've worked together for a long time. And maybe it's an essay question and there's a communication disorder. And they can't put their knowledge in words on paper. So it's okay. We talk about it, you know, and it's like, I know you know this. We've discussed it so much. So I'll let them draw a picture. And we did that recently on erosion. But drawing the picture stimulates everything they've talked about. It's like, oh, what's that? And I do things with asking questions because it's testing is their knowledge. It's not mine. And then they are able to put a label on and turn it in. It's like, wow, what nice work. It works very well, you know, teaching the way they do. And the teacher can't do that because she'd have to set aside 27, 30, maybe if it's even a larger class, for an hour. You know, it just, we have to educate all of our children. One thing that's been really successful at the middle school, we work really well together, is our special ed population. Their testing scores, if you take the report cards, you can break it down by the segmentation. And they have been highly achieving now for years, and it's really building. We've been maintaining in the top 10 in the state, which is good because we're very financially disadvantaged. You know, it's a poor sector. Unemployment is 9.5%. And unfortunately, that does impact education. Poverty does, and income. I work really hard. And I didn't realize when I took this on that I myself was placing myself to live just barely above poverty myself. I didn't think of that aspect, and now I'm evaluating where I am, what I need to do, because granted, I have a benefit package, but what is 6% of near poverty? That is poverty. When you retire and add my Social Security, which is based on my income, and then a summer comes around, how do I live? I'm not opposed to working. I love to work. I've done many things in my life, whether it's senior care, child care, working in a bakery, a motel. I'm a worker. I enjoy working. With a 9.5% rate of unemployment this year, because one of our mills collapsed, jobs are extremely hard to find. I don't know what I'm going to do to get by. I haven't been able to save enough up. My roommate died, which was my mother, but we split our bills, you know. We lived together for years. It was wonderful. And I truly need my unemployment. I pay into it. And it's really difficult when this time comes that I'm able to use corporate welfare to get by, but yet not unemployment, which I pay for. The unemployment fee, I pay half of it. My employer pays the other half. I can't do that, but yet I can be considered for food stamps. I can go to shelters for a food box. There's all kinds of, you know, I always thought of corporate welfare with the different corporations like Walmart and McDonald's. But I didn't really realize that until I was trying to figure out with my mother gone how I'm going to live this year. That, wow, that's what I'm employed with too. And we can rise above that. I think the state needs to set a little better example. And as much as that, value me for who I am and what I have given the system and my love for your children, your future leaders, and how much I try for them. I think you could value me with the respect of unemployment instead of food stamps. And my unemployment would be very small. One time I got it a few years ago, it was $131. But please consider this. My request for the Senate bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lambert. Thank you for your work and for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Taylor, and I am a classified employee for the Beaverton School District. With 14 years of experience as a paraprofessional, I am employed as a special ed program assistant. I work in a K-1-2 classroom, primarily with autistic children. I am at the top of my pay scale for my position, and last year my earnings were just under $22,000. Working for the school district is a labor of love as much as it is a professional career track. That is especially true for classified school employees, no matter what their job classification. Education assistants, nutrition services workers, some clerical, library and IT staff, campus security, and our transportation department are all seasonal workers. That's why our annual wages are so low, in spite of what might be considered to be a decent hourly wage compared to a year-round or 260-day employee. Our monthly earnings are the number of hours we work per day times the number of days in our respective contracts divided by the number of paychecks we elect to receive. I have the privilege of only receiving 10 checks a year from the school district. New hires to Beaverton School District are required to receive their compensation over 12 months. If that mandate had been forced upon me at the time of my hiring in 2006, I would not have been able to afford to pursue my career as a paraprofessional. I simply, even with a second job, there is no way that I would have been able to cut my monthly nut each and every month on the limited income I would receive. Summer is always hardest for district employees due to the loss of district monies. However, the burden falls typically to my second job, either for more hours or I need to go find additional sources of income. Typically, I do both in order to make it through to September 20th, which is when I receive my first district paycheck. This last summer, however, a special set of circumstances occurred. My second profession is as a professional personal caregiver, and after almost 2 years, my client and I mutually decided that we needed to have a parting of the ways. After July 21st of 2014, I received zero income until September 20th. And I will tell you that arriving at that September 20th date was almost impossible. August 1 is a terrible time of the year to be looking for a second part-time job. There just aren't very many to be found. And unlike every other classification of seasonal worker, either public or private, school district classified employees are barred by law from collecting unemployment insurance benefits. As I said, reaching that September 20th deadline was almost impossible. And I say almost because failure was not an option. I have a household to maintain and many people that count on me to come through each and every month. My rent was short paid in the month of September. Several of my bills went to 60 days past due. I had to make arrangements with other debtors in order to not fall into collections, and I received a forbearance for my student loans. I have to tell you, I went through every dime I had, and at 55 years of age, it's been a really, really long time since I was that broke. I had the misfortune or the privilege, depending on how you want to look at it, of having to go to some of our resources for food boxes in order to feed my family. And that has never in my entire life happened. It's taken months to recover from that financial setback. And in fact, January of 2015 was the first month that I was able to actually pay all of the bills that were due when they were due. And I do not live an extravagant lifestyle. I've worked my entire adult life contributing to a system willingly, and when I needed it desperately, that system was not there for me to access. As a classified school employee taking care of children, all of our children, how did I ever get so privileged as to be ineligible? And as an interesting side note, one of my coworkers, when I was having a conversation about this past October, mentioned to me that my employer pays unemployment insurance benefits on my behalf. I was flabbergasted, so I went back and checked my pay stubs, and son of a gun, it was there. I called payroll to verify that the line item I was looking at was indeed unemployment insurance, and it is. The district pays unemployment insurance benefits on my behalf, but again, the law prohibits me from accessing those benefits when I'm in need. I beseech all of you to consider deeply the inequity that is presented to you here today and to move forward successfully on the successful passing of Senate Bill 470.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sydney Meyer, and I'm a classified employee in the Corvallis School District. My career has spanned 31 years, and during that time, I've been a fiscal clerk and an administrative and operations assistant at the middle school and district office levels. My work is essential to the education of our children. You know, it's not just teachers in the schools and in the buildings. This is valuable and worthwhile work that I love my career. I work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. I have no paid vacation days. My calendar work days have throughout the years been mostly 210 days of work per year. Unpaid days off have been winter break, 10 days, spring break, 5 days, summer break, 35 days. As far as the school district is concerned, that makes me full-time. This has left me still working only about 80% of a typical work year. Through the years, I've explored employment opportunities that coincided with my unpaid days. I'm a dependable professional, and I have a high level of skills that are easily transferable into the private sector. And I've been unable to secure additional employment during forced days off due to the few and sporadic weeks of my availability. I watch my spending carefully. A newer car when needed or a yearly vacation are pretty much out of the question. Most of our classified employees have at least a 2-year college education. And the last figure I received from our school district was that 70% of them have a 4-year degree. So many school classified employees who due to the low pay and shortened work year live at poverty level. They receive public assistance, including free and reduced meals for their own children. Working in the schools in positions they love, but at the poverty level, is unbearable to a large number of our classified staff. Each year we lose newer and long-term employees who experience additional cuts in hours or cost of living doesn't keep up with what they need to make ends meet. Departing are talented individuals, taking with them a considerable amount of training and expertise. That valuable experience and those training dollars that have been invested in them are then lost. On a yearly basis, in the Corvallis School District, we lose 10 to 20% of our classified staff. It's a financial drain on our district to continually hire and train new employees. You know, the education of our children is bolstered by personal connections between students and their supportive educational staff. This high level of classified turnover causes disconnect and a slowdown in student academic progress as our classified employees are replaced and students are served by new and undertrained school staff. A conservative estimate of the dollars lost when classified leave and new employees must be hired and trained is about $900 each. And we saw 75 classified staff leave and be replaced over the past 18 months in the Corvallis School District. That's a minimum of the equivalent of 9 work days and hours spent in orientation and basic level training that needs to be provided to our new people. This is an average yearly low estimate of about $45,000. And this does not include the cost of staff hours involved in the hiring process, the cost of fingerprinting and background checks, or the staff hours spent in conducting those trainings for our new classified employees. As you're considering the potential cost of this measure, I hope that you will consider the hidden costs that are being paid daily by our classified members as a result of this unjust position. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Meyer. Thank you all for testifying. Questions of our testifiers? I do have a question for you, Tricia. So as I understand it, there are federal issues with school personnel accessing unemployment insurance during breaks, including during the summer, and those barriers are pretty strong for teaching employees. But for classified employees, it's left up to the state to, the state can choose to bar those employees or not, and Oregon has. And what you're requesting is that that bar be lifted. Is that sort of it in a nutshell?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's it exactly. The federal law prohibited all education employees at one time from receiving or from being eligible for unemployment benefits during between academic years. However, in 1991, the federal law was changed, and states were given the option with regard to classified school employees only to lift that bar. And that is exactly what Senate Bill 470 would do, is remove that statute, which prohibits eligibility. The employees would still be required to meet all other eligibility requirements for benefits that anyone would have to meet in order to receive those benefits, looking for work, those sorts of things.
Okay. And we will be hearing from the Employment Division to talk about sort of the details. Great. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
A question for, well, you'd probably know. Has this bill been brought up before? I had not heard of this issue before. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I'm sorry, Senator.
It's okay.
I don't know how long you'll need to be a senator before I stop saying rep, but yes, it has been brought up before. In 2003 was the last time that we had a hearing on the bill. We occasionally bring it up, but frankly, in the midst of the financial crisis when we were trying to keep our members employed, this wasn't an issue we thought was timely. So now that the economy is improving and we're beginning to think about how to rebuild our schools, we think it's important that the legislature realize that this inequity exists and we begin to think about it.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming and you know, talking to us about this through your own experience. That really helps. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call up David Gerstenfeld from the division. And Lori, you want to come up now, too? Lori Satinspiel. And while they're coming up, colleagues and members of the public, I should have said this before. If you're here for Senate Bill 555, we had a work session scheduled, but that will be postponed until next week. We're still working on amendments for that bill. David, you want to start?
Certainly. Thank you.
Sure.
Chair Decker, members of the committee, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Oregon Employment Department, here to testify regarding Senate Bill 470. The department is neutral on the bill, but appreciate this opportunity to tell you how we think that this impacts the Employment Department in terms of our administration of the program, and also how it would impact workers and businesses and the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. So I think there's been a good summary so far. There are some special provisions in federal and state law that deal with people that work for educational institutions. And what they essentially say is that usually people who work for educational institutions are not eligible to receive unemployment benefits during break periods. So this typically comes up during the winter break, spring break, and then the summer break period. Federal law divides employees into two categories when looking at educational employees. The first category are people that provide instructional, administrative, or research types of duties. For that category of employees, federal law requires that states have this type of special school recess provisions that we've been talking about. The other category of employees is everyone else. So those are the IT professionals, bus drivers, and any other employee. It doesn't depend on whether they are classified or not. For the federal law purposes, that's the dividing line that they have. States do have the ability to make the decision as to whether they want those same school recess provisions to apply to these non-instructional types of positions. So Senate Bill 470 essentially looks at the our current statute that does apply those school recess laws to non-instructional employees and repeals that. So what that would mean is that most of these non-instructional types of employees, if they meet the other eligibility requirements, would be able to claim benefits during summer breaks, winter breaks, spring break periods. In terms of what that would do for us administering the program, I want to talk about just briefly. We know that our estimate is that it's about 30,000 employees that this bill would impact who currently cannot get benefits during that time period and would potentially be eligible. What we don't know is how many of those people would actually apply for benefits and how many of them would meet the other eligibility requirements. For instance, some people may decide to travel during the summer or may not want to work during the break periods. They wouldn't apply. So when we were trying to get some real rough numbers for what the impact would be, we came up with a couple scenarios, but we don't have any history in Oregon to know how many of those people are really likely to apply for and receive benefits. There would be some additional work for the department because we would be getting some number of additional claims filed. So for the people that become eligible and do seek benefits, we would need to process those claims. It is a weekly benefit program, so we would need to look at week by week if they're eligible, and there would be some additional work when people didn't meet those requirements to then do the investigations, issue decisions, and potentially have hearings on those. So for that, we did some very rough estimates of what we think the fiscal impact would be to the department to administer the law, and our estimate is that it would be roughly $300,000 for a biennium for the increased workload. And again, that will probably vary depending on how many of those 30,000 employees do actually seek benefits. In terms of the impact on the trust fund and the businesses, I want to just real briefly talk about how most of the time unemployment insurance benefits are funded. For most types of businesses, they pay a payroll tax that goes into the trust fund, and that's used to pay the benefits that workers then receive. Nonprofits and governmental entities can be reimbursing, and most of the educational institutions are actually reimbursing employers. So what that means is they don't pay a payroll tax. Instead, they reimburse the trust fund dollar for dollar for the benefits that are actually paid to their workers. So what that means is that if this bill were to pass, it would likely not have a significant impact on the overall level or health of the unemployment insurance trust fund. But if it permits additional benefits to be paid, then those reimbursing employers would need to reimburse those additional amounts to the trust fund. Our estimates when we looked at a pool of potentially 30,000 workers, if we were to say that 10% of those workers were to actually receive benefits, that would be about 3,000 people getting benefits. We looked at about 14 weeks of benefits. It will vary depending on what institution they work for. And we used the overall state average weekly benefit amount, which is $318. So those are all some assumptions. When we did that, it works out to about $13.3 million per year if 10% of those workers receive benefits. If it were 50% of the workers that receive benefits, then it would be about 15,000 people getting benefits, and the cost of that would be about $66.8 million per year using those same assumptions. There is one wrinkle that I just want to mention at a high level for the educational institutions and for any employer that is a reimbursing employer. They have the choice of either basically paying the bill quarterly for the benefits that are paid out, or there is a special trust fund, a local government employer benefit trust fund. And what that does is it essentially works like the equal pay option that many utilities have. It attempts to smooth out the payments so that, for instance, educational institutions wouldn't get a huge bill right after the summer break period and then a much lower bill in other quarters. It tries to equalize that out over time. The end result is still that they're ultimately responsible to reimburse fully any benefits that are paid. And I'm attempting to explain something that confuses me sometimes, so hopefully this is helpful, and certainly happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Christenfeld. And we'll wait to hear from Lori on sort of a variety of questions, but I do have one technical question about the reimbursing employer that you mentioned. So we heard some testimony that something is being taken out of the workers' paychecks, but that's not a typical unemployment tax? Or
Chair Dembrough, for the unemployment insurance system, none of the cost of the benefits comes directly from the workers. So for employers that do pay the tax, for the ones that are not reimbursing, there is a payroll tax that the employers pay, but it's not a withholding. So it's not the same as, for instance, the Social Security that gets withheld out of your paycheck and then sent to us. It's just an additional payroll tax assessed directly against the employer.
Okay. So where does that money go to, in the case of workers like this?
Chair Dembro, are you meaning when there is for the taxpaying employers when the tax is collected?
Yes.
That goes into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, mm-hmm. And it sits there when benefits are paid out. That's where the benefit money comes from.
Okay.
Essentially for reimbursing employers, they're responsible dollar for dollar for the benefits their workers receive. For taxpaying employers, it's more of a traditional insurance model, where that's basically the insurance premium that the employer is paying, and it's more of a shared risk with a number of factors that go into the rates.
Mm-hmm. And so for the reimbursing employers, what would the indication on the paycheck signify?
Chair Dembro, I'm not really certain. That wouldn't be something directly related to the unemployment insurance program administered by our department.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yes. Senator Rosenbaum and then Vice Chair Thatcher.
And David, I guess it does seem strange that employers would pay a premium on a period of time where the people they're paying it on couldn't possibly collect benefits. How do you explain that?
Chair Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, for the taxpaying employers, that is essentially what's happening, is they're paying the tax, which is the insurance premium, when their employees would not be eligible to receive during certain time periods. In terms of the policy underlying at the federal system and what I assume was adopted when the state legislation was passed, I think the theory originally when these types of provisions were enacted was that traditionally a lot of school employees worked during the school year, didn't work during the summer. The idea was that if that's kind of the seasonal type of job that they've chosen, then there was a desire not to have the unemployment insurance program kind of subsidize the period when they weren't working. And I think that was a policy decision. And as you heard testimony, that's still a requirement for the education, for the instructional employees. It's an optional policy now for states to make as to whether they want that to apply to others. For reimbursing employers, there wouldn't be anything that they're paying. There's no analog. They're not being asked to reimburse benefits that workers don't receive. They really do just get paid after the fact. But for the taxpaying, there is the impact that you mentioned.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, I guess it was mentioned in testimony that some people have to take a check once a month for the whole year, so it's kind of annualized, but they're not working during some of those months. How would unemployment, I mean, if we were to go ahead and do this, how would that work?
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, we don't, the bottom line is it wouldn't really impact their unemployment insurance benefits. If they've elected, if they're being paid for 10 months of work, but they've made an election to receive their paycheck over a 12-month time period, the checks that they receive during the summer, it is an earnings for work they're performing during the summer, so it wouldn't really impact their unemployment insurance benefits.
Okay, and one follow-up separate issue, but you were giving certain scenarios, like if 10% and you kind of, you know, went out and extrapolated, that would be $13.3 million a year because 3,000 employees would be participating, and then you gave another number in there, and what was that? It was based on a certain wage, or was it based on a certain benefit amount, and what was that amount?
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, the other two numbers, one was the other variables are how long they would receive benefits, how many weeks, and for our assumptions, we used 14 weeks. So that would vary depending on the particular summer break period for the institution. The other one was how much they would receive per week in benefits. Mm-hmm. And for that, we used what is the current statewide average weekly benefit amount, and that's $318 per week.
Okay, so you weren't basing it on average wage of these employees then?
That's correct. We don't really have an easy way to parse it out in exactly that manner.
Okay.
Great. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. I hope I have a question that clarifies. So for the employer who is paying in, so there's it's actually reflected on the employee's check. If they were actually laid off or terminated and they qualified for unemployment benefits, they then could receive unemployment benefits under that scenario. Isn't that correct?
Chair Dembro, Senator Canope, I believe a couple things. There probably shouldn't be anything on the employee's check that would be directly related to the unemployment program that we administer. There are sometimes some private sector types of coverage plans also. If someone, under current law, if someone works for an employer, even if that is a taxpaying employer, so even if the employer is essentially paying a premium based on the wages that worker receives, if that person is unemployed during the summer break and they work for an educational institution, they likely would not be able to receive benefits even if the employer had paid unemployment payroll tax on their wages.
I'm not really being clear. So if that employee, though, so if the employer was paying in and that employee, it's not, we're not talking about breaks, we're talking about gets laid off because of budget cuts or whatever, would that employee then there be eligible for unemployment benefits?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. During periods other than these breaks, Okay. They would be able to receive unemployment insurance benefits if they meet all the other eligibility standards.
Okay, because
but let me follow up, because I'm not sure totally. So if a person is laid off and their layoff begins July 1st, right, because of a reduction, their RIFT, their reduction in force, so their position goes away. And if that starts on July 1st, do they have to wait until the school year actually begins again to start getting their first checks, or are they in another category and they can begin to get checks right away?
Chair Dembro, typically, they would have to wait until the break period is over. So you do sometimes have people, for instance, if someone becomes unemployed during the middle of the school term, they might be able to receive benefits until the school term ends. They would then not be able to receive benefits during the summer break, and then they could resume again when the next school year begins.
Yeah. It's a crazy system, I have to say. I say this from a large degree of experience. My wife actually experienced this once, where she was laid off, and she's a college teacher, and she received her benefits, and then the summer came, and even though this is college and there was a summer program, she stopped receiving checks and had to wait until September to resume those checks.
Chair Dembro, that's exactly how it plays out a lot of the time, and I appreciate your patience with me trying to explain the thing that is pretty complex sometimes.
Senator Knope, you had a follow-up?
Yeah. So do we know how other states deal with this? Are there, how many states do it this way? How many states pay in and allow the benefit?
I don't have that answer offhand. I can certainly find out how many states have made each decision for these non-instructional employees?
I would be curious how people are handling it. Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay, let's hear from Lori. I have a couple of more questions for you, David, but Lori's just sitting there impatiently. So.
No, I'm not. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards. Here today in opposition to Senate Bill 470. When the bill was posted, I sent it out to my school districts and asked the school business officials to say, okay, tell me what you've got for non-instructional, calculate if everybody did this. And so I was getting feedback, and I wanted to share some of those numbers. But I think what was most important first is to share some of the narrative that I got back, because I think that some of that's a telling tale and essentially you need to hear it. And if you see John Wyckoff walk in the room, I have his testimony that I'm going to deliver as well for community colleges. If he doesn't make it back, he's double booked. So I asked him if the bill goes into effect, and the response is
non-instructional staff are an integral part of the district and valued employees. These employees perform valuable services for students in our district. Most of our non-instructional staff know the job applies only to part of the year with a reasonable assurance that they'll return to work in the fall. Additional costs projected under this bill provide no benefit to the classroom. Over 90% of the costs would impact the state school fund. Unemployment benefits cannot be paid from the, some employees are covered by grants. So that was an issue for them. As you know, this is their statement, we pay 12 months of medical insurance. So they're being covered medical and for their work for just the school year. I like this one. We rely on many of our nine-month employees to return to the summer to help with summer projects. And so that may be an unintended consequence. And I think this one kind of got me to the impact will also be on the students. As districts have to deal with this fiscal impact, reduction in programs, reduction in staff, which results in larger class sizes to meet, you know, the costs. And Mr. Chair, the House passed out $7.255 billion. Legislators spoke at length about the adequacy of the budget, and I want to give you some specific numbers from a few districts just so you have sort of, and we're going to talk with Employment Department about some of this too, because what they did was try to take what their salary is based on what they looked up to say what this particular classification of employee would get under unemployment. Eagle Point, small district in Southern Oregon, $62,000 per week. Estacada, $400,000 per year. Lebanon, $832,000 for the next biennium. Salem Kaiser at $10 million for the next biennium.
And those are the costs of what?
The unemployment that they that business officials have calculated. And I will tell you, there's some averages. They're trying to say, okay, not everybody would do this. And so they're doing the best they can with their rough estimates as well. Central School District outside of Monmouth here, $2.5 million. They'd have to reduce 33 teachers in the next biennium. Oregon City, $3.9 annually. Medford, $2 million per biennium. Some of these districts contract out busing, so they have the less of the non-instructional folks. Hillsboro, $5.65 million for the next biennium. David Douglas, $2 million. Grants Pass, $791,000 per biennium. Tigard Tualatin, $1.8 per biennium. Portland Public does a lot of contracting for services with their busing, and they were at 3.3, and I contacted them to just talk about the differences between Salem Kaiser and Portland, and they did a real conservative estimate, Portland did. They said, you know, I don't think everybody would take advantage, and I want to make as accurate as I can with those numbers. Beaverton, 5.25 per biennium. Westland Wilsonville, $1 million. Central Point, 622 per biennium, 4.5 days, 10.2 teaching positions. And that's all I have for numbers. I just want to keep it short. If you have questions, I can move into community colleges if you'd like. Unless John shows up.
Questions on the K-12 side? Okay, let's hear the good news from the community colleges.
Okay. I shouldn't have asked John if he was coming to committee. He sent me his talking points. OCCA, Community College Association, John Wyckoff, I'm here standing, opposes 470, which would allow non-instructional employees to receive unemployment insurance during breaks between academic terms in the summer, holiday, and other breaks. This imposes enormous costs on colleges for whom employees who have reasonable assurances of continued employment due to the nature of the college academic calendar. The college calendar doesn't change. It's well known by those who choose to work in educational settings. Costs would be as much as 25% higher than currently budgeted for unemployment claims. This change applies to any non-instructional staff, not just to those who fall into the category of classified employees. So even those working in academic programs as non-instructional assistants, technicians, administrative assistants would be eligible. He says here one college has a estimated an additional cost and benefits for 10-month employees and those part-time employees defined as 500,000 in unemployment benefits. And it doesn't name the college. Finally, he'd like to raise an issue about the repeal of 657 or a 657-221. Currently, if an employee decides not to accept an offer of continuing employment, they're deemed to have voluntarily left work and thus are not eligible for unemployment. The repeal of 657 deletes that provision, then is not addressed in 657-167. The significant change in policy will further increase the number of potential claims and increase costs.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, both of you. Okay, so David, going back to you, are there other industries out there where workers routinely don't work during a particular season, and are able to get unemployment?
Chair Denbrough, there certainly are, and what it is depends on where in the state you are. Construction, especially outside work, road people that work on road crews, typically there's seasonality. Some of the agricultural work, there's a number of industries. Oregon doesn't have any provisions equivalent to the school recess provision that apply to them. There are some states that have adopted similar types of provisions to apply to seasonal work. Oregon hasn't done that, so the school employees are the only people in Oregon where this system kind of plays out.
And Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, I guess what I was just kind of hung up on where you talked about RIFT employees, and so somebody could be laid off, it sounds like, in July, at the end of the school year, but then not able to collect unemployment until the school year started up again. That seems like a really, well, odd thing to me. But going back to some of these other industries that may or may not have this assurance of being able to return, because they're kind of different than I see them a little bit differently than mm-hmm. school employees, where there's a school, there's a schedule, you come back, you're working from this time to this time, and those other industries are kind of all over the place. I mean, it's a little different in a way. So it just seems like you said, there's only in that there's somewhat of an assurance of returning, but then if there isn't, there seems to be a little bit of a disparity, an oddity there, where, if you can't get unemployment insurance for several months after you've been laid off, that seems kind of strange to me.
Yes, Chair Denbrough, Senator Thatcher, let me try to clarify a little bit. It does play out in odd ways. And let me back up a little bit and talk about how it actually makes people ineligible for benefits, because that might help explain these kind of gaps that pop up. When someone files a claim for benefits, we take a snapshot of their wages during a certain time period, and that's what we use to determine if they have enough earnings to get any unemployment benefits and how much they're entitled to get. What these school recess provisions do is they essentially say during these break periods, if the statute comes into play, those earnings get disregarded. And for many employees, that means that if you only worked for the school, for instance, then you have no earnings, you're not going to get any unemployment insurance benefits. The issue that you raised about the reasonable assurance, that is in the statute, and that's the legal standard that we applied. And I may have been a little overly broad in responding to your question, Chair Denbrough. If someone is laid off and there is it's very clear that their job is not going to be there for them the next school year, they may be able to receive benefits immediately, even if it is during a break period. The reasonable assurance threshold is not a real high one, so they don't have to have a guarantee of a job the next school year. We see scenarios pretty frequently where someone is working one school year, maybe they have a contract for a particular school year, and the contract ends, and there's no formal guarantee that, yes, we're going to have you back next year. Sometimes there's even concerns about, we'd like to have you, but we don't know about our funding. If there has been a history of that person returning year after year, we would probably still say that they have reasonable assurance, as the law is defined. So they would not be able to get benefits during the break. If it was a clear cut, you've been laid off, we abolished an entire program or department, we're not going to have you back next year, they could receive benefits during the break period. So I think I may have been over general in my prior statement. I did want to respond just briefly about one of the statements about people who turned down offers of work. If 657221 were repealed, then all of the regular unemployment eligibility standards would apply. So if one of these workers had an opportunity to perform work during the summer break and they turned it down, that could well render them ineligible for benefits. So I hope that answered the...
Yeah. Well, you know, I know growing up it was fairly common, you know, for local factories or mills to shut down for periods of time, 2 weeks, 4 weeks. And, you know, those workers would, you know, routinely get unemployment during that time. It was just sort of part, it came with the job, as it were. And, you know, I do see what we're talking about here as being somewhat analogous. You know, in my conversations with school board members, I don't think anyone has a philosophical problem with these workers being treated in a comparable way. The issue I think that they have is this would be seen as an unfunded mandate by the state, and if they could afford to do it, they would do it. Is that a fair statement, Lori?
I think that's a fair statement. They're valued employees like everyone else. I think that my folks were both teachers, and we loved the summers because we got to go everywhere, you know. It was a different scenario, I know, but I think that's still the mindset.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm curious, have any of the school districts looked at, it was brought up earlier, the costs of replacing employees, the turnover, training, and things like that. Have they analyzed that in light of, you know, what they were saying? I'm just wondering if there would be an offset.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I actually wrote that question down to go back and ask about it because I do have a question the same, and I don't have an answer, and I can get back to you.
Okay. All right, thank you both of you for coming in, informing the conversation. Great. Okay, colleagues, with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 470. Again, thanks to those of you who traveled to come and share your stories. I am going to open a work session now to introduce committee measures. We have a measure to be introduced.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. And Matt, could you tell us what it is that we are submitting as a committee bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 4110 requires all employers to implement sick time for employees and creates exceptions, specifies purposes for which the sick time may be taken and a rate at which sick time accrues, requires advance notice of request to use sick time when under certain circumstances, and prohibits discrimination against employees for inquiring about or using sick time. It makes a violation an unlawful practice subject to jurisdiction of the Bureau of Labor and Industries and authorizes civil action for violation. It establishes a state preemption of charter and statutory authority to set any employment benefit requirements and creates exceptions.
Thank you, Matt. Yes, just for the record, this came as a request, actually from the Restaurant Association, and there was some miscommunication. It really should have gotten into the queue earlier. And it didn't, but we're putting it into the queue now, even though I will say for the record it contains some things I personally don't like. However, I would entertain a motion to introduce it as a committee bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're agreed on that. All right, so Mr. Chair, I move LC 4110, dated March 27, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved LC 4110. Dated March 27, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? And again, colleagues, as always, the introduction of a committee bill does not speak to one's position on the bill. Okay. Any objections to this being introduced? Seeing none, LC 4110 has been introduced. Okay, colleagues, with that, I think we have exhausted our work for the day, and I will wish you a happy weekend, aside from the 2 days that come before those. We're adjourned.